Freddie, you were drafted at the age of 18. What was that experience like for you? I know that it was the 1960s, so there was a lot of turmoil and unrest in the world. What was that experience like for you?
You want to know about being drafted?
Yeah, because that's how we started off. We'll just talk about your experiences.
There was 8 of us in our county that got drafted that month. And it was, you get your notice and that's fine. I wasn't going to run away or nothing. My dad was a Marine, so my grandfather was in the Army. So it was just something that the family did. And so I went ahead and went in and served 2 years in the Army.
I want to talk about what was going on in the world at that time. There were some riots. And
oh, yeah.
I know we've discussed the National Guard and what they did. And if you could, just tell the listeners how that affected you, the National Guard's actions against students.
Yeah, talking about Kent State. Yeah. It was more of a shock, but being at 18 years old, you really don't understand the political part of it and everything. But I don't think it was right for us to be shooting on our own people. I still don't believe that we should be. That our military should not be looking at the American people as a threat. That we have a lot of other threats in our lives. But at that time, it didn't really focus to me as to exactly what they were doing other than they were protesting the war. Well, it really wasn't a war. It was a police action. And it was controlled by our government. And you just, when you're in the military, you do what you're told to do. Because I was already in when that happened.
Well, I know what it was like when I was 18 and I was undecided on my future and what I was going to do. And I know the military afforded you that opportunity. And you actually scored pretty high on your aptitude test.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I had really good math skills. So they ended up putting me, they sent me to Fort Lee, Virginia. And it was a 3-month training. And they were training me to be in a supply area for a depot unit where you log where everything is. I was to do the paperwork. And I never once got to serve in what they trained me for. So that, if they had of, I probably would have stayed in. But when I got sent to Vietnam, being that that's an engineer outfit that you work for, being doing that kind of stuff, I got stuck with an engineer company, and I was to replace their supply sergeant, who was supposed to leave. He ended up staying. He extended for another 6 months. So I ended up being first sergeant's gopher. I had it easy. We were a port construction. We saw some combat, but nothing like the infantry or the artillery or the Air Force or the air cav or anything like that. They were under combat a lot where we didn't see it all the time. So I basically had it fairly easy.
Well, you went to Vietnam in the latter part of the Tet Offensive. Can you explain what it was like for you going to Vietnam?
Really, I'll explain how I felt going on the plane. I was just a young guy, and the big jetliner had 240 some odd of us. We were going to replace people. It was not a unit. We were going individually to replace other people in other units. And it was fairly relaxed and everything, and I didn't think much about it until we got close enough to Saigon, where we landed, that some of the older sergeants and officers I looked around. They're taking all their medals, all of their ribbons off, everything off their uniform, even their rank, getting rid of all of that stuff. And I didn't have a clue. And then one of the younger guys says, that's so they don't get shot first. And then it hit me, you know, hey, this is real now. And once we got off the plane, you can hear the artillery and rockets, even inside going or at the airport, you can hear it around. And I heard it all the time that I was there, sometimes louder than others. But when you realize, yeah, this is for real, you change your outlook.
How long were you in Saigon?
Less than a day. They were waiting on us. And, they put me right on another little plane. And I think less than 100 miles where I was stationed at. Flew us over there, got us off, and there was a truck driver waiting there for us when we got off the plane. There was two or three of us that went to that company. And that was it. Then you meet First Sergeant and go through all the routines of everything and what you're going to do and all of this. And first thing he said to me is, well, the guy you're replacing is not leaving, so you got a military driver's license? Well, yes, sir. He said, don't call me sir. Yes, First Sergeant. He said, fine, you're my driver for now until I can find something else for you. That was it.
Other than driving, you also built piers and
yes,
did things like that?
We were a port construction the first 3 months I was there, and then we were working on as port construction, we were building on a dock. And then 3 months later, the main unit, which was in Cameron Bay, they left the detail there, which would have been our depot, or my unit. They left the same number of people there, and the rest of them drove down the coast all the way down to where we were, and we became a company. And then I was out all the time going out and looking at the pier and stuff with the First Sergeant. And they were building, this was no little one, they were building a big one for the big ships to come in there. And we also had barges that would go up the river. I never did do that. I was glad of that. But they would go up and repair bridges and things like that. And they would always get sometimes serious hits and sometimes not. But they always saw action. There was times I had to fill in as for the mailman because Top says, well, you go do this for now. I said, okay. I didn't care. I was there. I kind of enjoyed it. But at night when we would get motors and rockets sent at us, well, then you kind of worry about it. The way we were situated at my company space, one side was ammo dump, fuel dump for the Air Force base, which was on the other side. And then on the other side was the village, the town. And, of course, once that happened, we'd all have to fall out and go out and get on the line and by the gate and everything. And sometimes it was okay, sometimes it wasn't. So.
Did you have any memorable moments or close encounters while over there? I mean, obviously, the war was raging at that time, so I'm sure you did. Are there any that you would want to share?
The one thing that got me the most is my brother was in the Marines, and I went over there figuring he'd stay home because, you know, one brother is enough. He signed the waiver, and of course, he was up and by Da Nang and by the DMZ, and he got injured. There was some at night. They were bivouacked, and there was some grenades thrown in, and it landed on the guy next to him. He was killed. My brother was seriously wounded, but they had a paramedic with him, so he was able to stop an artery that was leaking. And they flew him out. And then I got a letter or a telegram from the Red Cross, because I was on his list, telling me what happened, and I panicked, and I just freaked out. And First Sergeant, he was great. He calmed me down, took me out for a little bit, and then says, okay, tonight, when we shut our office down, take you in there, and we'll get you to call and find out where he's at and how he is. And the time we got that evening, when I called, it's strange because you know, it's radio to radio type stuff. And so you end up with somebody translating for you. It was pretty cool in a way, but I couldn't get a hold of his unit. But his battalion was translating back and forth. And they informed me that he was shipped out to Japan. And that he was alive and he was going to be okay. And that made me feel a lot better. He was in Japan for, gosh, a month or two. But they sent him back. And then he became an MP in the Marines at Da Nang. So before I got to leave, Top let me have a 3-day pass, and I got to go up and see him before I left. And that was cool. But we had other instances, where we had, we got hit one night with some rockets, and the MPs that were the guards at our gate, they got a direct hit. And Top and I was the first ones up there. That stuff sticks with you when you see what you're not supposed to see.
Well, going back to your brother, you guys had written each other quite frequently, is that correct, prior to that? And even after that had happened, you guys stayed in touch while you were both over there?
Yes, we did. And it was pretty cool because when he writes, he would tell me what he'd see, because he's always out on bivouac and stuff like that. He was talking about how green their countryside is and the trees and the kind of bushes they had. And, you know, of course, the normal stuff, that you're okay and everything's all right. And I'd always write and tell him, well, I got it made. I'm not doing it. And everywhere I'm at, there's nothing but dead grass. Everything's dead. It's all sandy or dirty all the time. Yeah, it's totally different from where he, up north, than what it was down south. Of course, I was on the coastline because we were building the docks. And but it was, it was interesting. And, of course, we would let each other know if we heard from which one of our parents would write us or anything. I wrote him one time. It's after I got a package from our mother. And she, little Christmas time stuff had cookies in it and some other stuff and a little bitty Christmas tree, those kind you buy. And the box, everything in the box was, she had filled it with popcorn so everything wouldn't break. It's real popcorn. I ate it. It was cool. I wrote my brother and told him about it, and he wrote back and said he got the same stuff. So that was pretty cool.
Did it help to have someone you were corresponding with kind of going through the same thing that you were going through? And I know that you guys were close to each other growing up. So was mm-hmm. it helpful to have somebody to sort of share the experience and knew what you were going through?
Yes, and we still share it. We still find time, even though he's 250 miles south of where I live, we still find time to get together. And that's when I have my most peace and am able to express what I feel and let out emotions, is when I'm close to him, because he does the same thing. He's been 100% disabled for years because of all of his injuries and what he's gone through. So it's... Yeah, we're able to communicate, and we're able to relax, and we stay. I've already talked to him twice today. I called him, and then I called him after I went to the doctor today, and it was we're always talking, and we and need to get back together. I need to go down and see him again. It's been a month, so.
How long were you in Vietnam?
I was a short timer. Let's see. I went over. I got there around the 1st of June and came home the 2nd of February. So I didn't have a full year's time. And but that was fine with me. I didn't want to stay there any longer than I had to. And when you get there and you get in the company, everybody counts their days. So it kind of shocked several of them when I told them how short a time I had already. They didn't think that was fair, but, you know, what the heck? I'm here. So.
When you received notification that you were going to be going home, what kind of emotions did you have? What went through your mind?
Well, first off, I wanted to see my brother and got the notice 2 weeks in advance. And so I knew when I was leaving, and Top gave me a 3-day pass. I went and saw him, come back, and it was just anxious. Can't wait for that day to come. And every little noise you hear, you start worrying, you start looking around. You want to go home. You want to get out of country.
I know for many of the Vietnam veterans, the welcome home was not really a welcome home. Is there anything that you would like people to know about Vietnam, about the men and women who have served or are serving today?
Well, there's a totally different atmosphere how the public perceives or sees how today's service people are. We support them a lot more, but there was so many of the college kids that had left the country, went to school, or dragged out, or got married, had kids so they wouldn't have to go, because nobody believed that we should have been in that police action. And to me, it, when I come home and then run through my process of getting discharged and everything else, and I got my pay, first thing I did is got civilian clothes, put them on, because I wasn't going to wear that uniform home. And there was a lot of us that did that. We just didn't want to have the stuff that went on at that time. And I never got bothered at all by it until about 18 years ago. As come to work up in Kansas City. Went to work for a larger company, and I was on third shift, and most of the guys on third shift, 20s, early 30s, none of them ever been in service or anything else. And they thought it was cute to walk up behind me and set a cup down and stomp it just to see me drop or see me jump. And it got to where I couldn't hardly work with them. The human resource, they found out, so they put me on another shift. The production manager wanted their names, and I refused to give names. I said, no, they don't know. And they don't have the experience. They didn't understand. And the thing about it, my production manager was also a Vietnam veteran. And he was a lieutenant, so he was upset. He wanted names. And I just flat said, no, they don't deserve any punishment. They just don't know. And that's how I felt about it.
Well, after your service, your military service, your time with veterans didn't stop there. Even still today, you're working with veterans. Can you talk to me about what your involvement is today?
Yeah, I'm District 1 VFW commander, which covers 12 counties, from Ray County over 3 all the way up to Iowa border. We have 12 posts. And I try to visit them as much as I can. And I'm also a service officer. When I first got into the VFW, and this has only been like 6 years, because I just stayed away from everything up until then. Then our commander would meet once a month at our little restaurant there in Lawson, Cadricks, and we would have veterans come in so we can sign them up to get their benefits and stuff. And I liked doing that, so I learned more about it, got more involved with it. Then I started, I went into the Excelsior Springs VA clinic, asked them if, when they first opened up, they had a service officer, and said no, and they would love to have one. So I went through all the proper channels, different district, and you have to go to the KC VA hospital to get authority, because the clinic is part of the hospital. And got authority to where we can go in there and sit and do events. So then I put ads in the paper and started helping veterans. And there is so much that today's veteran, or the older veterans, don't know about the benefits. And whether it's your retirement, a pension, or your medical benefits, all the other benefits that are available for veterans, including the state of Missouri, has a lot of benefits for veterans. And these, I'd learn it and I'd start helping and teach them. And those that needed hearing aids or had medical problems, that was, you could relate back to our time in the service, especially the World War II veterans, the Korean veterans, the Vietnam veterans, and since then even more. We would get them, they'd bring in their copy of their DD-214, that's their discharge. We'd fill out a form, and we'd fax that into St. Louis. There's three of us now that work out of Lawson doing this. We used to take a Wednesday at the clinic and do this. But I'd take it, and we'd fax it to St. Louis. The VFW has 9 paid service officers. All the rest of us are volunteers, and all we do is get the basic information for them and their DD-214, send it to the St. Louis office, that's the main office, and then they assign those to the different service officers in the state, the closest one to where the veteran lives, and they do the helping. The VFW then represents that veteran to get his claim process through the VA, and it helps tremendously to use a service officer, whether it's the VFW, American Legion, Vietnam Veterans of America, Disabled Americans of Veterans of America, and all the other service organizations, and there's several others, that then for somebody, a veteran, to use one of them to help them. Because if you just go straight to the VA, 90% of the people that work for the VA, it's just a job. They really don't understand or know the benefits. They don't know the packages. And the VA was established in 1901. And that was the beginning of benefits for veterans. There's been changes through the years, primarily because of our times and how much money there is and all of the different things that have happened. Since 1901. They were there for the Spanish-American, and then World War I, then World War II. And even when the Vietnam veterans went in, we were drafted, or they volunteered, whichever person would do. Nobody in the military would explain to you about your benefits. But today, if you go look for a job, even those that sign up to go into military, the main reason is because of the benefits. The benefits have been there. They just never told us. So that's why the guys that volunteer to be service officers do this. And every one of our posts has a service officer. So there's not any reason why any veteran won't use this, because it's there for them, has been all these years, and they need to realize they're not taken away from somebody else, because it's there for all of us, even for the ones that come home today.
If a veteran that is in your district, I guess for any district for that matter, how do they go about contacting a veteran service officer or a VFW or a local organization that could help them?
They can look them up in the phone book or online. American Legion's got a really good program. The VFW does too. In fact, all of them do. At the Kansas City VA Hospital, every one of them have a service officer or two. Offices set up with secretaries. They're helping veterans all the time. You just walk in. You get in there and make an appointment or call. Or if you can contact anybody that's in a veterans organization, they would know where the service officers are or who is available in their area. it's just, you can find them. Every VFW post has a service officer. It's part of the program of the VFW. And it's our duty to help other veterans. And that's what we do.
I know for some of them, the process may seem daunting, and I don't want to get too personal here, but have you taken advantage of the benefits, and what was that process like for you?
Yes, I am classified at 70% disabled. First thing I filed for was hearing. I got ringing in the ears, as they call it, tinnitus, and that's because the artillery units that was next to us just kept going off. And being engineers, we didn't get no hearing aids or hearing protection. And it's real loud. And even right now, it's louder than I'm talking. And then I got hearing aids also. And I got 10% disability for the ringing in the ears. And on the hearing aids, it was listed as 0% service-connected hearing loss. And that means they'll provide you with hearing aids at no cost. The hearing aids are over $3,000 a piece. And you get them supplies, your batteries, cleaning material, everything you need for them for the rest of your life. If they need replaced, they replace them. And you can get retested as you get older. And then I had three stents put in. So it's called stemless heart disease, caused from Agent Orange. And they gave me 10%. I appealed that because I felt like it should have been higher, because they just fixed three arteries. And then when I got a coffin pin, I explained to the lady what they've done is this: it's not the heart, it's my arteries. I have blockages in other areas, not in arteries, but in veins. And explained all the problems and stuff. And I got an additional 20% for that. And then in January, because I've been seeing psychiatrists and psychologists for my post-traumatic stress disorder, they finally had a comp and pen for me. That's comp and pen is compensation and pension hearing. And when I went in for that, I just told the lady, at the time I didn't know it, but she was a psychiatrist, that the money don't matter. Not to me. I could care less about money. It's just the fact that they drafted me, they put me over there, admit you made a mistake because you screwed my head up. And I take medication now to help control it. It's sometimes it's adequate, sometimes it's not. But all of a sudden I got a notice that I got 50% for PTSD. And that gave me a total of 70%. hey, it's really surprised me. You know, heck, I'd have been happy with 10. I didn't care. Just acknowledge it. The government should acknowledge what they do to everybody. Now, when they come home, even before the service guys and women get out of the service now, they're treating them for PTSD right now, beforehand, because they realize from what has happened in the past, especially the Vietnam era. When we were in Vietnam, we saw combat, not all of us. The majority saw combat about every other day. World War One and World War Two in Korea. Theirs was like 2 to 3 weeks between combat because they'd all get ready before they'd make their moves and stuff and whatever. Where we didn't have, our enemy was jungle fighters. So you never knew when they would do something. And you in the daytime, it could be some young guy or some kid or even a lady or a female. And you wouldn't know it. You'd get friends with them, talk to them. And then you find out later.
Well, Freddie, is there anything else that you would like to add?
I just like for every veteran that has never tried to find out their benefits, because that's what they are, their benefits. Get a hold of somebody and find out. There is so much that's available for the veteran and the spouse, and even a widow of a veteran who has seen combat. There is benefits for them.